This is a rebroadcast of Migrant Matters. You're listening to CFRU 93.3 FM in Guelph.
Thank you. Well, Carmes, I was asked to say a few words about women in the Soviet Union. So I think the first thing to say about the Soviet Union is that it was the first socialist country in the world. And before that, the ideas of socialism, of working class state, a country that was ruled by the working class in the interests of working people, and where big corporations and so on didn't exist, and where there was no monarchy, and where feudalism was abolished and so on. It was all theoretical before 1917. So when the Great October Socialist Revolution actually happened, it had a huge impact, not only obviously in the Soviet Union, but worldwide, because here for the first time was a little piece of territory that we could, or quite a big one actually, that socialists around the world could point to and say, there, that's what socialism looks like. That's the experience. That's what's happening to people in that country. And that's what's happening to women in that country. So women around the world looked to the Soviet Union to see what was happening to women in that country. So I think the first thing to say is that, well, the struggle for revolutionary transformation took decades, more than a century of struggle prior to 1917. Once the revolution took place, and it did involve some women, but the conditions that the new revolutionary government was faced with for, you know, the departure point from that was capitalism, this is socialism, well, the conditions were horrendous. Amongst women, it was almost 100% illiteracy, just to give you a picture of the departure points. Most of the country had a feudal mode of production. It wasn't even capitalism. It was mainly people lived in feudal conditions, so that means women lived in feudal conditions. Most of the country had no electricity. So at one point, Lenin famously said, socialism is electrification, because it had to do with the development of the country. Capitalist relations, so industrialization, for example, was just beginning, and only in the European part of the Soviet Union, what became the Soviet Union. And most of the rest of the country was under agricultural production, but in very feudal conditions. On top of that, it was a matter of the Great October Socialist Revolution took place on actually November 7th on our calendar. So it was a matter of less than 3 months, so 90 days. Later, the country was invaded by 13 imperialist armies, including you may not know this, including the Canadian Army was one of them. And so they spent almost 3 years fighting off invading armies. You can think of it in contemporary terms as the U.S. sends in the Marines, you know, whether it's the Middle East or whether it's Latin America or wherever it is, whenever they see something progressive happening or working people taking charge, they send in the Marines. So that's what happened in 1918, January 1918, with the Russian Revolution at the time. So the tasks were enormous of the first socialist government, to defend socialism, to prevent the new government and workers' power, Soviet power as it was called, from being overthrown, to fight off those feudal forces which were major, and to skip a stage, if you will, of development in most of the country, because historically it's, you know, for primitive communism to slavery to feudalism to capitalism to socialism and communism. So what they were proposing to do, what they had to do, was to skip the capitalist stage and move from feudal relations of production to socialist, and that was enormous because of not only the economic conditions but also the cultural part of the equation, how women saw themselves, how they were seen in society, what power they had, what rights they had, and so forth. And then, of course, there was also the burgeoning capitalist class in the European part of Russia, which had no interest at all in ceding power to the new socialist government, and they also fought back. And so they were in a, you know, it wasn't a situation of an easy transition. Okay, we won, now here, let's plan out how we want to proceed. It was a tumultuous time, and defending the revolution, making these big transformations, electrification, feeding everybody, all putting everybody to work. These were, and winning the whole population for socialism. That was a big, all these were a big factor. And you'll see similar problems existed, or similar conditions existed in most of the socialist countries to one degree or another. Some had more or less conditions of feudalism. In China, for example, the Chinese Revolution in 1949 faced similar conditions. The main mode of production was feudalism. And in Cuba, not quite the same, but also great backwardness and you know, massive poverty and not very developed capitalist relations. So this is probably not going to be the situation in Canada or in the European capitalist countries or in parts of Latin America because of the development of capitalism. So that in Canada, for example, obviously we have electricity in most parts of the country. We have most people are required to go to school, and most people have a modicum, elementary at least, education, although post-secondary is getting harder to access, but conditions are quite different here. So the tasks that the socialist government had were essentially to very quickly, on the economic side, change the relations of production to fight off those forces, political forces in the country, which were opposed to public ownership, to industrialization of the country on socialist lines, to bringing the whole population into the process of socialist construction, with that in mind, with bringing women into the process of construction, meaning economic in terms of employment and so forth, but also cultural. So, and I suppose that's the first thing to note, you know, and I was, nothing ever takes place in a vacuum, right? It always takes place in concrete conditions. So you're starting with what you've got and moving from there. So very early in the revolution, essentially as soon as they had got rid of the or fought off the invading armies, all sorts of laws were introduced in the Soviet Union that affected, had a direct impact on women. The USSR Constitution from this time, about 1918, was the first, one of the first laws passed was to guarantee equal pay for work of equal value. That's a long time ago. When you think how long it's taken for women in Canada or advanced capitalist countries to win that. Actually, I think recently the postal workers only finally won their pay equity payouts that had been guaranteed 30 years ago.
The Equal Rights Amendment in America still hasn't ever passed.
Yep, there you are. So almost, what is it, 95 years ago from 1918?
Yes.
Women were guaranteed, I hate that, you just take this into the right to work. You know, right to work has a dirty, is a dirty word today, but the meaning was the right to a job, the right to employment. The right to maternity leave. This is around, you know, almost 100 years ago, a year. They were guaranteed a year of maternity leave
with pay.
Lighter work during pregnancy, if they were working while they were pregnant, with no loss in pay. No night shifts or overtime for pregnant women and those with small children. A lot of women who work night shifts would like that today in Canada. Paid breaks for nursing women and childcare in the workplace as well as outside of it, so women could choose. The right to divorce, a big deal, which isn't guaranteed in large parts of the world, including advanced capitalist countries like Ireland, for example. Still, you cannot get a divorce in that country. A 5-day, 41-hour work week. 41-hour work week. This was in 1970. with the introduction of the scientific and technological revolution during that period, the work week was actually falling. The number of hours that workers were working was declining. And by that time, everyone in the Soviet Union was guaranteed a month's vacation, for example. Retirement at 55 for women, 60 for men, 55 for women. And in some cases, depending on how many children they had, they could retire at 45, and some even at 40, depending on what their occupations were. There was employment equity that was guaranteed in 1929. So the glass ceiling, the laws were put in place to eliminate that. I said a few minutes ago that so many women were living in conditions of feudalism when these laws were passed. You could just see the huge leap forward that this would have meant for so many women. So you have the laws are in place, but how do you enable those laws? How do you make them come to life in, for example, Kazakhstan or in the Asian republics of the Soviet Union, where these economic and social conditions existed, where women were in the main wearing burqas and were regarded pretty much as slaves, as household property of whoever they were married to. And there are some very interesting stories, which I heard actually about the role of the YCL in those Central Asian republics. I had a chance to visit Siberia during a trip there in the 1970s, and the YCL apparently at one point a young woman had been confined to barracks by her father, and they snuck into the house and grabbed her and spirited her away. And there was a big debate about this because, of course, that was illegal. On the other hand, apparently the YCL just decided they were going to do it, and they did. And this had a big impact, a big social impact, because there was a huge social debate about what had happened and so forth. But what happened was that the new Soviet government, not just in Europe, but in all of the republics, was fighting to bring industrialization and to socialist construction, to transform the country from a feudal economy into an industrial economy with public ownership and so forth. And in the countryside, this meant collectivization of farming, for example, instead of small plots of land owned by this family or that. And there was a real struggle. You probably are aware of the series of books called Quiet Flows the Don. This is about the European part of Asia. Anybody know those books? Anybody read them?
Shalikov,
yeah. No, well, let me suggest you get a read if you want to know what conditions were like. The author's name is Shalikov. What was his first name?
Michael, is it Michael?
Yeah, that's right. Michael. Shalikov, Sholokov. And there's three books called On Quiet Flows the Don, and it's about this period. And this is not in the East, but it's in the European part of Russia at the time, and it describes what happened in these small rural communities that had been, in these feudal conditions, and the Communist Party came in, and the local Soviets were elected in the big struggle to transform conditions. And some of them, it is a very raw picture, but a very accurate picture, and also talks about why people thought the way that they did, how they, what was in their heads, how could they do things. There's one scene in one of those books where the old lady, the old matriarch in the family, they figured that she's old enough, and so they just lock her out of the house at 50 below zero, and that one less mouth to feed, So how could you do that? How could, So anyway, the books are about these things. It gives you a very pretty good insight into the, I guess, the challenges of the Cultural Revolution. So in any event, as they were working to transform the economy, they also had to transform the way that people saw things, the way that they understood their lives, and why they needed to be involved in this process, not just the communist cadres who were sent into those areas, but to have, you know, the party people had to win the populations, some of which were very resistant. And this included women, and that meant that the women's question had to be addressed, the question of women's equality, women in the economy, women at work, women's rights, and so forth. And this was, a revolutionary transformation that took place. And we all know now about the big debates around burqas and veils and whatnot in Canada. There were similar debates at the time, in the context of Soviet power, of socialism. And what happened was during the 1930s, there was, who was it, 19, just a minute here. During the 1930s, anyway, there were mass meetings of women that were held in the Caucasus and in Kazakhstan. And of course, and women at that point decided they just had enough. A lot of them just dropped their burqas and started wearing the clothes that everyone else wore, and it was just a massive public rejection of that kind of oppression and repression of women and women asserting themselves and demanding that they be in their communities allowed to go to work. Without, you know, attacks on them, and to be allowed to vote, and be allowed to develop as equal partners in society, in short. And I think the thing to say here is that as distinct from Canada today, and the debates around burqas and veils and so on, this was the women themselves that made this decision, right? They chose to sever those ties to sort of feudal relations and patriarchy and so on. And what we're discussing today in Canada, sadly, because of the Conservative government and so on, is forcing women, which is a different cup of tea entirely. So this is what socialism is all about. So bringing women into production and so on, and was obviously very closely tied to the Cultural Revolution, and I mean that in the terms of the way that people regarded women, how men regarded women, how women regarded themselves, and so on. The Communist Party made big efforts right from the beginning, even while they were, you know, right faced with all these other tasks, of establishing committees at the factory level, in the agricultural sector, in co-ops and State Farms and so on, everywhere and at every level, of committees for work amongst women, how to challenge patriarchal ideals, male chauvinism, male dominance, to fight for women's equality in the workplace, in society, big efforts to advance women. This was a key part of the revolutionary transformation, was to bring women into production but also into leadership. So that meant education. I said at the beginning that there was almost 100% illiteracy amongst women. So that meant organizing adult education schools that were targeted at the whole population, but major efforts were made to get women there because it was harder to get them there because of the conditions that they lived in. And then to advance them at the factory level, on the farms, at the workplace level, to advance them into positions of management in those enterprises, you know, factories, farms, and so on, to advance them in the trade unions, because all of these enterprises had trade unions, so to encourage them to join. Nowhere was there any force, right? Women were recruited. They were won to these things, to go to school, to join a trade union, to advance within the union. Big efforts to put women in leadership positions in unions, to elect them as deputies or MPs, you could say, or MPPs, or at the municipal level, and into government. And you can see through some of the figures that they move very quickly. In the early 1920s, and the number of women elected as deputies was about 4%. 3 years later, it was 12%. And by the 1970s, it was over 40%. And that doesn't sound so great, except that if you consider that in the advanced capitalist countries, at the same time in the 70s, there were maybe less than 20% of women in the House of Commons here in Canada, for example, in that period. So there was there were big changes, and there weren't just some changes, and then that was it. There was a movement to involve women at every level of socialist government, socialist construction, and it was you could see that the gains were increasing with every. With every five-year plan, with every opportunity for women to advance, it was driven, it was organized by the Communist Party, by the trade unions, etc. And you probably have all heard, or maybe you haven't, of Valentina Tereshkova, the first woman astronaut, cosmonaut, they called them. And this was a deliberate. Soviets, in the course of the space race in the 1970s and 80s, wanted to make sure that the first woman in space was from a socialist country, not from a capitalist country, and it was a deliberate decision to do that. Well, let's see. About the question of education, the first task, of course, was literacy. But beyond that, this was also true in Cuba. There were mass illiteracy in Cuba too at the time of the revolution there, and also in China, but which I know less. But anyway, one of the first things that happened in Cuba too was adult education, and students were sent out into the countryside to teach older workers, younger workers, anybody who wasn't educated. They would give them the ABCs, and the effort was, to give everybody, get everybody literate up to the grade 4 level, and then up to grade, 8, and up to grade 12, and so on. And this was the main task during the 1930s, and it was in the post-war period that major efforts were made to advance women. And men, because in a post-secondary education, because post-secondary education before the revolution had been for a tiny elite of very wealthy people. No workers went to university or post-secondary. Most had no education at all. So there was a systematic advancement of women and of all workers during that period. I want to say something about the war years. I think if socialism had been allowed to continue without the interruption of World War II and the loss of 20 million Soviets, that socialism would have, we would still have a big socialist world here, right, globally, and probably much more advanced than it was in 1990 when the Soviet Union collapsed, and that capitalism would be much more set back than it is today. And sadly, that's not what happened. Life intervened, fascism arrived, and part of the reason why 20 million Soviets died was because the advanced capitalist countries thought that enabled fascism, if you will. Their hope was that Hitler and Mussolini would turn their attention to the Soviet Union and would attack socialism and destroy it, and then perhaps in the process Hitler would also be destroyed, and bingo, Bob's your uncle who's left, imperialism and capitalism. And this had a terrible toll on the whole country. You can read the statistics. I'm not going to give them to you, but vast stretches of land were completely leveled during the war. Many people were killed, but the economy was also in ruins on this side of the Ural Mountains, in the European part. And so much had cities were completely leveled. And if you've read anything about World War II and what happened in the Soviet Union, you'll get a picture of the devastation that was left, and they had to rebuild everything. But they had to rebuild it without these 20 million people, most of whom were men. And so one of the things that happened after the after the war was that there was this huge demographic change. Suddenly there were all these women and no men of, or very few men of, you know, marriageable age, because it was the young men in the main who were killed, right, in the first place. Well, of course, lots of people were killed, but in terms of the demographic shift, so this really changed things in terms of women's roles. It meant that at the end of the war, when in the capitalist countries, the men came home and took their jobs back, and women were sent home, which was a really shitty thing. But anyway, that's what happened. That didn't happen there, and women stayed in production. They would have stayed in production anyway, but it also meant that they had to take on, a lot of women had to take on the job of reconstructing those cities in the post-war. So they had jobs to do, they had this massive task, and there were a lot of women who were unable to marry because there weren't enough men to go around. And so new forms of family relationships were established, and it was not uncommon for some men to have more than one family, and you can see why that would have happened. So that as the generations were born after that, things shifted, but it did in a way, I think, open the door for some attacks on the idea of the patriarchal family, right? This was not a socialist concept anyways, it was a capitalist concept, but it helped to move things forward. It was sort of one of those unexpected things. In the 60s and 70s, in the post-war period, the capitalist countries worked very hard again, economically and politically, to attack the Soviet Union. It was unending. It never stopped. And the same thing is true of Cuba. I'm sure somebody's going to be speaking about that in a minute, the blockade and everything to strangle socialism. That's what it was all about. And the scientific, this is also the period of scientific and technological revolution, which was a boon, but also it had a downside as well. One of the downsides was that the capitalist media was able to beam across the world pictures of capitalism into the socialist countries, saying, this is how we live. We live very well. We can do all kinds of things you can't do. And this had a big impact on countries like the German Democratic Republic and the European parts of the Soviet Union. And how big an impact was it? Well, you might think that it's like watching TV commercials, right? You see people, buy this car. If you buy this car, you're going to have a good life. You'll have a lot of women friends. You'll
use this deodorant.
Or use that. You know, you we're all familiar with this stuff. But in the socialist countries, they actually believe all this shit, right? They believed it. And I had an experience when I was in the Soviet Union. We were traveling, and we were taken to visit a collective farm or a state farm or some farm anyway. And at the time, I was in my 20s, so they decided that I should speak to the to the young people who lived on the farm. And I said, what do I say to these? I don't know anything about farms or farm kids in the Soviet Union. So anyway, we decided I should just tell them what it was like living in Canada. And at the time, we had relatively low unemployment, but, we were telling them about that. So they were politely listening, and then there were questions. And one of the first questions was, what kind of car do you have? I said, I don't have a car. Oh, you must have a car. All North Americans have cars. I said, no, I don't have one. Well, it turned out, this conversation, there were more questions like that. And then after the formal part was over, a bunch of them came over to speak to me. And it became clear they didn't believe me. They thought I was bullshitting them. I must have a car. Everybody has a car. It's common knowledge. All North Americans have cars. They all, and furthermore, they all have dishwashers. They have hair dryers. They have all sorts of things, all kinds of commodities that are not available in the socialist countries and that people want, right? And this became a big factor. It's also a factor in Cuba, with, Voice of America and all kinds of media, which can be beamed from anywhere in the world now, and the internet and everything else, you know. So this kind of propaganda. And so when I was talking to these young people, and I said, look, a lot of people do own cars in North America. You have to have one if you want to work. That's the way it is. But the banks own them. And they own our houses, too. We get to live in them. But, for the average family to actually own a house, and many people do own houses, but by the time they finish paying their mortgage and the interest on that mortgage, they're going to have probably bought that house two or three times the price they paid for it because of the interest, you know. So they said, and I said, then what about your homes? How do you live? Oh, well, they pay 10% of their income and the house is theirs. So, okay, well, a little different, right? So anyway, this was part of the downside. The other side was it made work much easier. And the socialist government responded by reducing the work week, increasing the benefits that people had in terms of higher wages and more services. Healthcare and so forth, all kinds of services that were available, but the consumer goods were not available. And this was something that people had wanted for a long time. Rising living standards means that you have to also satisfy the material needs of people, not just the necessities, but the additional things that people want. And this became a factor in the collapse of the Soviet Union. Not the only factor, obviously, but it became a factor, and it was the Cultural Revolution, if you will, that people's minds were actually being bent on a regular basis by the kind of propaganda that was being sent out. So on the other side, one of the reasons that Canadians and others in advanced capitalist countries were able to live as well as they were was because of the existence of the Soviet Union and the rights that women, for example, and others had in the Soviet Union and the other socialist countries. So, and what the capitalist class was trying to do on a global level was to say, well, working people of Canada and other countries without socialist governments, don't be taken in by the fact that they have full employment in the socialist countries, that they have Medicare, that they have, month-long holidays, they have holiday residences that everybody can go to, that their conditions of life are pretty good, and that they have come from from feudalism to the conditions of an advanced capitalist country. Because, say the capitalists, we can meet that and surpass it. We can give you Medicare. We can give you universal pensions. We can give you employment insurance, or unemployment insurance, as it was called then. We can give you rising wages. We can, life is better in capitalist countries. At the time of the collapse, one of the things that the Communist Party said was, and Communist parties around the world said, watch out, working people in capitalist countries, because the shit is about to hit the fan. You are going to lose everything that these capitalists allowed to develop in the capitalist countries because they had to compete with the socialist world, and that included rights for women. And you can see, comrades, it happened so fast. We have been in a period since the 1990s almost to the date, right?
Of
cutting, privatizing, eliminating, the idea of job security, who has that? Nobody has that. The idea of Medicare under attack, and there's going to be a big summit and protests and so on in 3 weeks in Niagara on the lake, because Harper is going to try and get rid of the deal with provinces that protect Medicare to some extent, and the federal government, conservative government, is moving to open the door wider to privatization of Medicare. Employment insurance, only 20% of workers in Canada now are able to collect employment insurance, and pretty soon it'll be gone if we continue following that direction. You are the first generation in the last 100 years who are going to be actually poorer than your parents. In terms of employment, your ability to accumulate wealth, housing, A lot fewer people, if you live in Toronto anyway, are going to be able to afford to buy a house in your lifetime. It'll be old before you can do it because of the cost of housing, and so on and so on. And on top of all that, we're on the verge of another deep depression. And not to talk too much about this now, because I know we're talking about women. Maybe I'll talk a bit more about it later. But the economic situation in the United States, which on the news says is much better and life is good now, and they're creating jobs and we're not and all that, it's all rubbish. Actually, they're in a very, very precarious situation. We live next to an elephant. If they go down, we go down. That's the way it works in capitalist countries like ours, because we're so interconnected with the U.S. So it isn't only Europe. In any event, the whole issue of women's rights, well, the same thing. Everything is under attack now. When I was, I was 22, I think, the first time that I ran as a candidate for the party. And one of the big issues at the time in the country and in Alberta, where I was a candidate, was women's rights to reproductive choice. And I remember the guy I ran against, a Tory, was a real pig. And he said the best way for women to control themselves is to control themselves and put an aspirin between their knees. There, that's what they need, you know. And I thought, holy shit, you know what? Anyway, we fought it out there. This was in the early 1970s. The women's movement was born in Canada and in the advanced capitalist countries in the fight for these kinds of demands. And finally, that battle was won in Canada. You know, Morgenthaler, the big battle there, but it was the women's movement, the trade unions, and the people's movements that finally won that. Well, women's right to reproductive rights in the Soviet Union were guaranteed 1918, and here we are today, going into another battle on the issue of abortion. It never dies. This thing, they keep turning it around. And the reason for it, by the way, is because if women don't have control over their own bodies, then somebody else is going to control it, right? It's a way of oppressing women, of controlling them. And if you can do that, then you can make more money from them in terms of profits, right? There's a reason why women or people of color are subservient in terms of their class. It's because it has to do with making profits. If you can exploit one group and pay another group higher and another group lower, you can divide them, you can split them, and you can make bigger profits. That's what it's about. So now that the socialist world is much smaller than it was in, 1920 or 1950 or 1990, all of these things are under attack. And then there are new issues, like the issue of GBLTQ rights. I see you were talking at some point this weekend about transgender rights. All this stuff is under attack because they cannot tolerate equality. Equality means lower profits. That's what it's all about. One other thing I wanted to say was the difficulties of the period with the scientific and technological revolution. And this whole issue of consumer goods, which was such a big issue, and pushed very hard by the capitalist class, and that is that the Soviet Union as a state poured billions and billions of dollars. This is money that was made by workers in the Soviet Union, right? That's what the source of it. That's work is the source of all profits and all funds. And a lot of money was not put into the production of consumer goods. It could have been, but it wasn't. So where did it go? It went to help the people of Cuba. It went to help the national liberation movement in Africa and in Latin America. It went to help the people of Vietnam, fight and win their war against the United States. It went to send, as the Cubans are doing now, sending doctors around the world. Well, who pays for that? The Cuban people pay for it, and the Soviet people paid for this too. And it was a form of international solidarity, which had a basis underneath it. Obviously, if the if the transition to socialism, which at some point is going to have a global character, I mean, the whole world will be socialist at some point because it's an objective process, just as, you know, the world's people move from slavery to feudalism to capitalism. So at some point, the world's people will all move to socialism as well because it's science, right? But the question of when... When will the conditions be such that the peoples in each country will move to socialism? Well, in part, the things are being speeded along here by neoliberalism and by austerity. People are pretty fed up with what capitalism has to offer in this country. And increasingly, you're seeing people say, well, we're anti-capitalist. We have an anti-capitalist character to the struggle in people's consciousness. But it's to get people to... Being anti-capitalist isn't enough. You have to be not just against, but for. And the more that people know about socialism and what socialism's actual history is, as we're talking about today, and what it means for the future of people, when you take out private ownership, when you take out exploitation, when you take out oppression, when you add inequality, when you change the system so that we're talking about workers' power, working class power, people's power, and the interests of people, a society that's built to meet the needs of people, that is a very magnetic idea. And I can say that in the current political situation where I guess where I started from, the conditions in which a revolution in Canada will take place are very different from what happened in Cuba or China or the Soviet Union, because the material basis of industrialization is here. That is, if they don't close everything down before we get there, they're doing a good job of closing down our manufacturing sector. But we are not illiterate people. We're not living in feudal conditions. So the actual transformation of the economy should be much easier. But the cultural revolution, the way that people think, may be more complicated. I remember discussing that with some of our women teachers when I was at the Lenin School in Moscow. And this is the biggest challenge. It was one of the biggest challenges in the Soviet Union. And it is today as well. I have... a comrade from Cuba who was living with me, and I asked her, she's an interpreter, and she's here studying, she works for UNESCO in Cuba, and I said, you live in Cuba, you're Cuban, what do you think about the conditions of women in socialist countries? What do you think? And she said, well, there are two things that need work. I said, okay, well, what are they? And she said, well, the first thing is domestic labor, right? That women carry this double load. And they still carry a double load. And obviously, women in capitalist countries do too. Although there's been some shift, but not a very big one in terms of a division of labor between men and women in housework and domestic work. On the second question is attitudes, men's attitudes towards women, and that this has got they've got a long way to go. And I remember my mother telling me she was in Cuba. We were at one point going to move to Cuba as the party there had asked our party to if there were people with skills who could come down and help them, because at the time of the revolution, all of the skilled people pulled out. The United States pulled them all out, and they thought they could cripple the revolution that way. And anyway, she was there for 3 months during the Cuban Missile Crisis, and she told me that some experiences she had that were pretty interesting. And one of them was being on the buses, which were very crowded because they didn't have enough buses and so on. And at that time, everybody was armed. The Cuban people were all armed because they were worried about an American invasion, and the entire country was armed. So on the buses, you would have people with their submachine guns over their shoulder, right? And those were the conditions. The people were armed. And some guy pinched this woman's bum. And she turned on him with her submachine gun. And, you know, well, this is one way to change people's thinking. But it's just an example that women, when they are empowered... legally empowered, and they have support of society as a whole to assert themselves. They do, But it also shows that the cultural aspects, the way that people think, is so ingrained, not just, you know, for the 25 years that you're alive or the whatever it is, but you have generations of thinking this way. And so it becomes, everybody thinks that, everybody knows that, and whatever it is, that women are no good at mathematics. Well, everyone knows that, right? It's common knowledge. And suddenly, this is a way of thinking that is, it's capitalist thinking. It's to keep women in low-paid service kinds of jobs, domestic labor, and so forth. And there is this we are surrounded by this kind of thinking. And how does it come to us? Well, it comes to us through the organs of the state. It comes to us, and what are they? Schools, right? Churches, the media, yep. Everything that has to do with developing those sort of common views that we all have in a society. So that is why it is so important when I'm sure you're studying this at some point, that when the socialist state takes over, it takes control of all of these things and make sure that different ideas about women and what their place is and what they can do and what they need to do and what society needs to do to help them to move forward. These are very important things. And, of course, in part, they're connected to the what are the actual possibilities in this or that country during the revolutionary period. So what I want to say again about the Soviet Union, those conditions were very, very difficult in 1917. And yet they did amazing things. And for us, when our revolution comes, when we make that revolution, a lot of the tasks that were so difficult for the Soviet people will not be difficult for us. But I really do think that the changes in the way that people think about themselves and others, and including the conditions of women, are going to be a challenge. Even though women are making strides and have made strides and are fighting back against the attacks on them, I think we're going to, you know, and part of this has to do also in the Canadian situation now, that men and women have to stand together in order to fight these governments and these attacks. But it's, you know, you see, it sometimes is worrisome what you hear from people that in the 60s there was much, for example, which was a period of 60s and 70s, which was a period of international liberation, forward movement globally and in many countries. A lot of the ideas that people had at that time about themselves and about about gender roles and gender equity, those ideas somehow are not present in the same way anymore. There are many people who don't see things that way. So we have a big challenge, but it's very nice to be sitting at a table and speaking with you where two-thirds of the seats are filled by women, and not just any women, but very activist women, communist-thinking women, so this is a very good sign. And it's also very nice to see the men who are here, because this is not only a struggle of women, it's a struggle of all communists and the struggle of working people generally. So on that note, I will stop, and thank you for your attention.